Work moves fast. Every email, report, and proposal counts. That's where Grammarly comes in. It's your one place to think, write, and finish. Grammarly's AI agents help you find natural phrasing, fine-tune tone, and confidently write wherever you work. It's the premier writing tool that 93% of users trust to get more work done. In a world of generic AI, don't sound like everyone else. With Grammarly, you never will. Download Grammarly for free at Grammarly.com.
Off the Ball Daily.
A home for your favorite podcasts from Off the Ball.
You know, obviously there is a natural thing of like, we need to keep the game going and so on. But the first thing is like, provide the bloody games. Provide the opportunity for kids to play.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah?
Yeah. I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football. They just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12. I love playing 10. I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team. Thank you, France. Merci la France. Merci les baguettes. Merci les croissants. Je vous aime. I love you.
Hello, Susanna here, and welcome to Word on the Street, the pod where we take kind of the noise and what everyone's talking about out on the ground and we bring it into studio. And this week, I think you would have had to be under a rock to have missed Fergal Guin. I think that's his last name. Sorry, I butchered it earlier. But yes, Guin, I'm correct. I had to ask him. We will be chatting to him shortly, but he cycled all the way from Roscommon to Sydney, and the videos have been all over my Instagram this week. So I'm here with Rachel. Are you the same? Has it been everywhere?
It has. Yeah, it has. It was... You know, the weather's been so bad over the last week or two, and just being reminded of all the scenes in Sydney and the fact that it's the height of the summer there was just really adding insult to the misery of the weather during the week. But it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Emotional.
Like, hard not to get emotional watching those. And I'm like, I think he'd come up on like my Instagram a couple of times like throughout the year, but nothing as heavy obviously as the last like week when he was kind of on the home stretch into Sydney. And the crowds that showed up for him, like, I'm not surprised, but I can just imagine the atmosphere that was there. Like, anytime there's an event like that in Australia, like, where there's a big Irish crowd celebrating something, it's just so positive because everyone's like, you're so far away from home and you kind of want to, you're nearly showing off, being like, look at us, look at our community, look at what we're doing. Because sometimes they get a bit of bad press over in Australia for
the Irish.
Yeah, just, you know, for like Christmas Day drinking on the beach kind of thing, whereas this is just
Bondi, red swimsuits.
Exactly. This is such like a good news story. It was really beautiful to see.
So you said you had come across him. I remember like 8 months ago, people talking about this guy on Instagram, this Irish lad who was traveling through Afghanistan, and everyone was like, what a freak. Like, what the hell is he doing in Afghanistan? And it was kind of brushed off in a sense of like, oh, I don't really know what that's about, but amazing.
Yeah, good for him.
Good for him. And now to come out the other side and get to chat to him and like hear about his journey and what he actually did was incredible. But had you kind of picked up on him throughout?
Just bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Like bits and pieces. Again, one of those just like, it was probably Afghanistan, I think, that I had heard about it as well. Cause
yeah, I think it floated around.
Yeah, it was just like, oh, be careful.
Yeah.
But I can't wait to listen to your chat with him, because you know when you read things like that, you're like, oh yeah, obviously that was scary, but getting first-hand experience of what really happened in those countries.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And he tells us a little bit about getting drugged and attacked in Iran, which was insane. But what was really incredible was kind of what took him through all of that, and he spoke about like external motivation and the work he did with the charities, because like I'm a wimp, but if I was drugged and attacked or just really sweating, to be honest, or going up a hill, I would quit there and then. And for him to cycle 30,000 kilometers across 2 years in dangerous countries, minus 22 degrees Celsius, plus 50 something degrees Celsius, and keep going. That was really what I wanted to get to the bottom of, was like, how did you find the motivation within you?
Yeah, like, because it's not a race, you know.
No.
You're not competing against other people. There's no motivation there to be like, oh, if I don't finish this, someone else is going to win.
Yeah.
Like, it's purely internal. And obviously, the charities and the work he was doing was a big thing. But to be doing that on your own, like the mental strength that that takes is
That's
just,
a good point. It's not competitive.
It's not competitive.
It's not even like competitive spirit, really.
No, not at all. Obviously, he's in competition with himself every day when he gets up on the bike, yeah. But it's everything is coming from him.
Yeah. It's also mad that he... Now, the Irish Times say he had never ridden a bike before, rode a bike before, sorry. I don't think that's entirely true. I think he had rode a bike, but he wasn't a cyclist.
Yeah, he wasn't one of those ones that would rack up like
50K, like off to Wicklow. Yeah, no. He was a runner, and then he bought a secondhand bike. All of his kit was secondhand. Everything he set off from Ireland with was all he had throughout the 2 years.
Like, when I go down to Cork at the weekend, I bring a 30kg suitcase. Like...
That's what I was like. I was like, would you not have bought a coat when you were in minus 22? And he was like, you would think so. But no.
Fair play.
Yeah, fair play. So we won't delay any longer. This is Fergal Guillen. As many know him as Rosie to Ozzy on his journey over the past 2 years. All right, I'm delighted to be joined by Fergal Guillen. Most of you might know him as his Instagram handle, which is Rosie to Ozzy. He has just cycled 30,000 kilometres over the past 2 years from his hometown in County Roscommon to the Sydney Opera House, where he landed into huge crowds on Saturday. Fergal, how are you?
Hey, I'm not too bad. Thanks for having me on, guys. It's been a crazy last week, so it's great to find some time here to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you for slotting us in amongst all the coverage you've been getting. I have to ask, I'm sorry to start the interview on this personal note, but it's the question that's been at the front of my mind since I heard what you did. How is your backside after 2 years of cycling?
Well, I say I've been asked that question a lot of times throughout my journey and a lot, especially the last few days. It's actually all right, would you believe? It's been a lot of cycling, like 20 or 30,000 kilometres, 28 countries, 3 continents. And somehow, and I'm lucky that my arse has withheld then that distance. But yeah, the body held up pretty well and it's great now to be finished and being able to rest.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that route. I know it's all available for people to see on your Instagram, but where did you start? When did you start? And what countries did you go through?
Yeah, so I started in Ireland in March 2024 and I would have got cycled from Roscommon to Dublin and then got a ferry to France. It was then down through Europe, across through Turkey, and I gained some confidence from there and I would have went through Iran and Afghanistan, which even at the time there was a lot of conflicts on. Then I went through China, where I spent 4 months crossing through the Taklamakan Desert up onto the Tibetan Plateau, where it's minus 22 degrees. And then down through Southeast Asia, through Indonesia, I made it as far as Timor-Leste, which is only 700 kilometres to Darwin. And from there, I flew to Perth and I cycled across the entire continent of Australia, across the Nullarbor and to here where I am, Sydney.
Was it 30,000 kilometres exactly?
No, so it might have been about more than 29,000 kilometres cycled altogether. But originally, the route was only meant to take 23,000 kilometres, which was a rough estimate. But I changed my route to go through maybe some rougher terrain like Iran and Afghanistan. And then I had the entire Chinese route, which was it took me four months. And I went a bit more of a rogue route going up onto the Tibetan Plateau. And it was winter as well, so that didn't make things easier. And then I even continued along to the Indonesian islands further than I expected to go to get to Timor-Leste, where I hoped to have got a boat to Australia. But instead, I opted to, after 3 weeks of looking, to fly to Perth in Australia.
Why did you decide to make the route even harder?
when I started, look, I didn't know if this was possible. I'm not a cyclist. I'm not really camped much before at all, and I'm a general nurse. So I was a nurse emigrating to Australia. And from working as a nurse, I realised that I'm not going to live forever from working with people in the last few days of their lives. So when the opportunity came to move to Australia, I said I would like to do it a different way rather than just going out and sitting on a bar stool every weekend. So I opted to I was a runner. So I thought it would take too long to run to Australia. So I decided to cycle there. That's what I took up. And I didn't know if it was possible, but I said I'd rather try and fail than to not try at all. And here I am after that, after making it. So it's a bit surreal being here with just an idea turning into reality.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you remember the moment when the thought kind of floated into your mind? As in, like, where you were when you thought, oh, maybe I might cycle across the world?
The exact thought, I guess it would have been a process to be like, well, I might cycle, because it was two of my friends actually mentioned it to me first. They were like, well, we might cycle to Australia. And once they said it to me, yes, I couldn't get it out of my head. So the idea wasn't necessarily mine, but then I couldn't get it out of my head. And I said, well, I'd love to join you to do this cycle. So they were him and on, and they said, well, yeah, you have to save up enough money and you have to prepare to do it. So I saved up enough money. I was planning everything, getting everything in place, why the other two guys never did. And I said, when they backed out, am I just going to, you know, leave this, not do it just because two people aren't going to join me? And yeah, I just said, no, why would I not? And why would I not just do it just because I wouldn't have some company for it? So I also had a large amount of fear heading into something like this. So what I did was I put everything in place so that I couldn't back out. I got the charities on board that meant the most to me. I would have planned
the route and that kind of thing.
Yes, I would have sorted out the route, like done up my route. I would have like tried to convince my parents, and I just kind of put everything in place that I couldn't back out, started to tell people. And yeah, here I am and delighted. The hardest thing I did was actually leaving.
Yeah, I can imagine. What did your parents say and your family when you told them about your mad plans?
They weren't, I guess, too agreeing with it to begin with. Like, my parents, I'm the youngest of five children, and my parents would have, you know, grown up with five kids during the recession was pretty difficult. And I think the best thing that they ever did was any money problems they ever had or anything, they always hid it from us. And what they actually did was always said, there's always a way. Like, we never seen the worry that they would have had, but they never showed that. And I guess that portrayed into me where I became such an optimist, because I never was seeing the worry that maybe my parents had when they were raising us. And that optimism, I guess, is a reason that I would have left on this trip. And as I guess, yeah, it's also a reason that I became a nurse as well. My parents would be very loving, and my dad's a very emotional man. So I came into nursing probably from watching him throughout my life. Then when I guess I was telling them about my plan, they weren't too agreeing. Like, they were obviously, I never cycled before, I never camped before. And when I was recording a promo video for this cycle challenge, I was camping out in my back garden, and the guy came and he was recording me camping in the back garden. And my dad came out the back, and he said, he had tears in his eyes, and he said, how are you going to camp in that for a year? Like, that's not possible. And I didn't have an answer for him. I couldn't say, well, it is possible, or I couldn't say, oh, it'll be fine, because I didn't know myself. But I said to him, I'd rather try and fail than to not try at all. And I guess he can't believe it that I met it here as much as I can't believe it. But it just shows what optimism kind of does. And I wasn't the person who could cycle from Ireland to Australia when I started. I was just the person who could cycle from Roscommon to Dublin, and then from Dublin to Paris, and from Paris to Munich, and Munich to Greece, and so on. And you become the person along the way. So if anyone can take anything for that, it's just to start whatever your passion is, and you just develop into the person who is the professional by the end of it. And for me, I guess I can say that I'm a well-traveled man now, and it's easy looking back to say that I can do something like this. But when I started, I was fairly raw.
Yeah, that optimism must have been huge, carrying you through some of those countries that you mentioned. I mean, going through the likes of Iran, Afghanistan, I've been to Tehran myself, and it's not an easy place. Was there ever a moment of, like, fear, I suppose, for you?
There was a massive amount of fear. So I, like I said, wasn't meant to go through Iran, Afghanistan. But when I was in Turkey, I met a guy cycling the inverse route. So he was cycling from Australia to Ireland. And I got talking to him, and I said, well, what was your route? And he said he went through Iran and Iraq. And I said, you can go to them countries and not die, because that was my perception, because that's what was told to me. So when he said no, he had an amazing time. He came across amazing, generous, kind people. I was like, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And despite feeling this overwhelming level of fear, I still decided to go that route. And that was the make or break of my trip. I guess I still felt that overwhelming fear, but I knew what it was. It was fear. I don't know what was ahead of me. It was the unknowingness. And having known that I was going to come across nice people, from what he said, was enough for me to try it. And when I got there, it was incredible. I couldn't take out my camping stove without... I couldn't put up my tent. There was people dragging me into their houses. There was people handing me food and not allowing me to pay for it. And it was incredible. You said you were in Tehran yourself, and I'm sure you would have come across the similar kindness.
Yeah, no, they're an incredibly friendly... population and people are just living in a very difficult country at the moment. But it's amazing to get to kind of see that side that you might not have. Was there any other highlights kind of across the trips, or moments when you were on your bike on your own and just thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm here?
Plenty. Yeah, plenty. I guess Iran, Afghanistan were two of them examples that I was like, why am I here? Like, countries that I never thought in my wildest dreams I'd visit. And I did say about the massive amount of kindness that I did come across. But with that, I had the fear. And with that, the governments, obviously, you have to be really careful with. Like, the people are... So what I've discovered along my journey is that people are people and governments are governments. And in Iran, I had to be very careful of what I said or the people I talked to, because I could be locked up for a long time for whatever reason. So unfortunately, there is a lot of drug abuse in Iran. And I have one very awful situation where I was drugged and attacked, and I had to go to hospital and get 7 stitches on my foot. And that was a really... awful situation, and I felt so bad to talk about it, because it was in a country that I only came across kindness in. But from this one awful incident, the amount of kindness that came out the other end, like from the consultants and the radiographers that I met in the hospital, I still talk to them. It's incredible. Like, they were so apologetic that something like this could happen in their country. And then I guess going through China, it's a country that not anyone spoke English. It was so different to even Iran, Afghanistan, where if someone spoke English, they'd run up to you. But in China, it was no one even spoke it. So even in the middle of the Tibetan Plateau, where it's like minus 20 degrees, there was nights that I was brought into like a little shack by some people that were living up there, like some locals, Tibetan herdsmen. And they took me in and they cooked me a meal, and we told stories by Google Translate, and it was incredible. It just shows how people are people everywhere. But yeah, that was a difficult situation when it's minus 20 degrees. You are really relying on the help of locals to take you in every now and then.
Yeah, on a practical note, like in minus 20 degrees, how did you dress for it? Did you kind of have to buy clothes, or were you carrying everything on you?
That would have been smart, but I had... everything that I used was on me from when I left originally. So all my stuff was secondhand. Like, this journey is completely self-sufficient. Wow. I left with, a plan and an idea and secondhand equipment. So when I was in China going through this minus 20 degrees temperatures, I was just having to layer up. I didn't have a down jacket that could sustain minus 10 or minus 15 degrees, but I had a Under Armour body warmer. I had a down jacket to a certain degree. I had like multiple t-shirts, and I just layered up, and same with my feet and my legs. And it was incredibly cold. like, there was no getting around it. It was painful and it was difficult, but I guess the scenery did make up for it. Like, looking at snow-capped peaks along the Tibetan Plateau, coming across yaks in the middle of the road. You had Tibetan herdsmen moving the yaks. You were seeing the culture up there, that they're all Buddhists. So they were doing their different prayers, which is like prostrating, I think it's called, where they kneel, they bow to the ground, they stand up, and they do that over and over again. And it was really incredible to see these incredible Buddhist temples even up there, and all the prayer flags. But then when on the flip side, I went through plus 52 degrees and 100% humidity in Thailand and Cambodia. And that was, I would say, worse than the colds. And coming from the west of Ireland, I'm a farmer. I'm out in the fields of Arigna, of Roscommon. You know, in winter, it'd be absolutely freezing going around on the quad. And I'm able for the cold. But when it comes to the heat, 100% humidity, 52 degrees, trying to camp in your tent, it's almost impossible. I was like a fish for the entire day. Like my fingers were completely wrinkled up. And then you're just trying to put up your tent and sleep, and you can't because you're just so sweaty and disgusting. And yeah, that was extremely, extremely difficult and also extremely dangerous with the, like I say, the amount of times I came close to heat stroke was a scary amount of times. But yeah, I'm very fortunate I made it this far from, I guess, the kindness of locals. But also, like, it took 2 years. I took it slow when I had to take it slow. And yeah, here I am.
Yeah, no, it's insane. But what motivated you then in those moments of, like, I'm about to pass out from heat exhaustion, but I'm not going to quit?
So I, before I left, knew I needed some external motivation. Like, when the going gets tough, there's only so much that my mental capacity could withhold with my own willpower. But if I had an external motivator, so what I said was I need to get two charities on board that meant the most to me. And I got Mayo Roscommon Hospice Foundation and Northwest Stop Suicide Prevention Services to raise money for them along this journey. And the reason I chose them is that I have, I guess, personal reasons to the two. I would have family members that have unfortunately passed away from suicide throughout the years. And my aunt would have passed away from suicide. And it was a thing that I didn't even find out until I was in my late teens, early 20s. She passed away when I was 4. And I had to ask my older siblings what happened to my aunt. It's something that's, I guess, even back then, it was, there's such a stigma around it and no one wants to talk about it. And then fast forward to when I was 8 months into my journey, my cousin Tom, who was 28 at the time, unfortunately passed away from suicide as well. So I was in Tajikistan at the time, and I flew home back to Ireland to spend the week or so with my family for the funeral. And I made sure that, you know, we spoke about it. Like, what was the problem? It was mental health. And why, you know, why aren't we talking about it? And it was just something that, I guess, it motivated me more when I got back in the road, that it's something that's so not talked about. And if I can somehow save another person's life from talking about mental health and about suicide awareness, well, then that's an unbelievable motivator for me for the rest of the way. And then with Mayo Roscommon Hospice Foundation, my great granny would have received care from the Hospice Foundation. When in the last, great granny in the last month of her life, she was 99 years old. And it was incredible care that they came to the house. She was able to pass away peacefully there. So I was like, no brainer coming from Roscommon. And I'm sure the people from Mayo would agree. When you hear the word charity, you think of Mayo Roscommon Hospice Foundation. It's just something that in every school, in every community, it's talked about. They just do phenomenal work. And now they're building the first children's hospice on the Western Seaboard. So you can imagine, if you're a family that requires hospice care for your child, how much you need that extra support. So being able to raise funds for a charity such as Mayo Roscommon Hospice building facilities like this was an extra, definitely an extra motivator. So yeah, if I didn't have the charities and the support of my local community, there's only so much willpower would have got me through. So it was, I'm very grateful to the charities, the people I met along the way, and my community back home that supported me.
Yeah, 196,000 raised so far when I checked this morning, which is absolutely amazing. And people can still donate at the link in your bio on Instagram, which is Rosie to Aussie. Just before I let you go, because I know you've got plenty more interviews to get to, I think everyone will have seen the Instagram videos of you arriving at the Sydney Opera House and the incredible crowds that were there. Firstly, were you expecting those crowds? And I suppose, what were your emotions when you finally rode in?
When I originally left, I didn't even know if it was possible. I was trying to convince myself even to leave and go on this journey. So I obviously imagined arriving at the Opera House because I needed that end goal. I needed to envision it, to actually know when this journey would end and to imagine coming in. But never in my wildest dreams could I imagine what there was. Like, it was incredible, the support by the Irish out here in Sydney. The sheer number of people, I guess all my friends, and to me it was obviously very emotional finishing up like this, but all my friends and their friends were saying how like the atmosphere was electric, how it was just this massive amount of Irish pride. Like, this was a story of immigration, what I'm doing. I'm a nurse, I'm moving to Australia to work as a nurse, and everyone else that was there were majority Irish, and they also emigrated out here. And it was just this level of celebration, and to do it at such an iconic landmark, it was incredible. And I don't think words will ever be able to portray the emotions that I felt. And seeing my dad at the steps of the Opera House was incredible. My dad, my siblings, it was something I'll never forget. And I think from hearing from my friends, I think it's something that anyone that was there won't forget anytime soon. It was really special, and I'm extremely grateful to the people that have put the time and work behind getting such an event like that put together at the Opera House. It was hard done. So yeah, my whole journey, I've relied on the kindness of others, and this was one of those moments where the Irish community got together and made this event what it was. So yeah, it was incredible. The Irish community in Sydney have overdone themselves.
All right, thank you so much for chatting to us this morning, Fergal, and best of luck with the rest of your Aussie adventure.
Cheers. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah,
I believe in Mike Hankey, and I suppose they're good at football, they just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12, I love playing 10, I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters, thank you for the team, thank you France. Merci la France, merci les baguettes, merci les croissants. Je vous aime, I love you.